Berkey purification systems, and they can also be used to upgrade most other gravity filtration systems. They can purify raw, untreated water by removing pathogenic bacteria, cysts, parasites, trihalomethanes, and chemicals such as chlorine, atrazine, styrene, and MTBE. These elements also reduce unwanted heavy metals such as lead, mercury, and aluminum. Unbelievably, they even remove small microparticulate from water like food coloring particles. Yet, they leave in the nutritional minerals that your body needs. Moreover, because they are recleanable, black Berkey elements are more economical than the standard disposable elements, providing fresh, pure water for less than 2 cents per gallon.
Get it. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it is going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Joseph Farrell, who has written a number of books that deal with the supernatural events that are going on and have gone on in the past. Because, you see, we live in a material dimension, and most people, you know, they feel that everything is, well, it's just exactly as it appears to be, and yet they really don't understand that there is our supernatural forces. There always have been. If you are a Christian, you've read the Bible, you will know that there are many, many things that there that cannot be explained in the dimension that we live in. I mean, how can anybody walk on water or command the cloud, the storms to stop, or the waters to surge, stop surging, or be raised from the dead, or raise others from the dead? These things just don't make sense. Unless, of course, there really is a supernatural dimension. And one of the most difficult things is to get the good people who should be understanding these things to realize this is not imaginary but real. Well, Joseph's done a tremendous job in his books. Joseph, thank you so very much for being with us.
Hi, Dr. Monteith. Thank you for having me back.
Well, what are we going to talk about today? Do you want to talk a little bit about our nation's capital? What would you like to talk about?
Well, I'm not really a political person. I don't normally get into political commentary.
All right, fine.
You did mention an interesting thing about illusion. And as you know, most of my books have been about Nazi Germany, secret weapons research, and so on and so forth. But there is an aspect of illusion to Nazism I think that's very important that people understand. And the illusion was essentially that the Nazi Party as a political ideology, as a political movement, and that Hitler and his henchmen were portrayed to the German people at the time by the political spin masters of the period as being kind of political messiahs. And I have a great dislike, a distaste, and I think it's founded in some history, that whenever we see movements for political messiahs, we end up getting exactly that. We get an illusion. We get basically short-term spin-doctored solutions for things that simply are not beyond, you know, political solutions. I think that many of the problems that Germany and the rest of the world had at the time were spiritual. And the Nazis stepped in and filled the void basically with an ersatz stew.
Well, I think that's a good analysis. And, well, we can talk about the Nazi movement because it's certainly one of my favorite sources of things that we want to talk about here. The fact that certainly you could never understand Nazism and the way that they, you know, really many of the amazing things that they did as far as their technology was concerned.
Yes.
And the way that the Nazis were able to control the people.
Yes.
And their belief in the really supernatural force, they believed, you know, in this age-old Aryan movement, certainly, as you well know, why many of the followers of Adolf Hitler and Hitler himself were disciples of Madame Blavatsky. But you go ahead and you pick up this story.
Well, yeah, that's an excellent point. Madame Blavatsky, the theosophical movement, did have an effect really all over the world at the time, but particularly in Germany, because, as you know, Germany in between the wars, and I just had a book come out that kind of traces some of this activity. Germany between the wars was really kind of a hotbed for all sorts of secret societies and fraternity movements and so on and so forth. And theosophy certainly figured into the thinking of at least a couple of these. One of them was called the Thule Gesellschaft, or the Thule Society. And if you dig in the record books, I go into it in this latest book that just came out and called The Philosopher's Stone. If you go into it, the Thule Society...
Hold on, Bob, please. We'll be back in just a moment. We bring other stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joseph Farrell, and we're talking really about his latest book, which goes into the background of what was going on in Germany at the time of the leading up to the Second World War. And unless you understand the spiritual forces at work in Hitler's Germany, you really can't understand so much of what's going on in America today, because those same identical forces are here that have the same goals and the same objectives. So Joseph was telling us about the Thule Society, or how do you exactly pronounce that?
It's a hard T, Thule.
Thule, okay, go right ahead.
Well, the Thule Society, as I was mentioning, picked up on Madame Blavatsky's theosophical ideas, and one of the major points that they picked up was the idea of there being root races, five different civilizations, five different races. And the last sort of pure race were, of course, the Aryans, and this figured very prominently into Nazi ideology. And I mention the Thule Society simply because if you look at some of the membership lists of this society, you'll find that many of the major financial players inside of Germany at the period who later became backers of the Nazi movement were precisely members of this society. So it stands to reason then that you have all of these very esoteric and occult doctrines that come into play in the Nazi Reich. And there's certainly another fellow that we have to pay attention to, and this guy, his nickname in history is Himmler's Rasputin. If you can imagine Heinrich Himmler, someone like him, having a Rasputin, that tells you how bad things really are. But this character, his name was Karl Maria Willigut, and he, for a period of time, was on the personal staff of Heinrich Himmler, who, of course, was the head of the SS. But Willigut was really nothing more than one of the premier occult scholars or esotericists of the day. And he exercised a profound influence over Heinrich Himmler, in that I suspect that he was one of the guiding lights, as it were, for the fact that the SS set up what was called the Ahnenerbedienst, which was basically an ancestral research bureau. But here's the curveball. When Himmler set this up, Dr. Monteith, he put in his decree that one of the purposes of this society was to investigate all avenues of esoteric occult tradition for its potential military application.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with all of our stations. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Joseph is telling us about Hitler's Germany. And, of course, there, of course, you had a strong occult underpinning of the entire Nazi movement, of Hitler, of Himmler, of all of these people were involved in the occult. And certainly the SS was involved in the occult, too. In fact, one of the interesting things is they all had a special sort of almost like a magical ring that they would
wear.
And, of course, basically most people don't understand that within our special forces today, city, every unit will have a magical ring, and somebody gets a chance to wear that ring. It's almost a replay of the SS. People don't like to think about it, but the same spirits and forces are right here in America. So any way you pick up the story of the of certainly the occult forces within the SS, the occult forces within the German. Well, the whole structure of the military, the SS, the special forces, all of these groups over there in Hitler's Germany were involved in the supernatural, and of course they were believing these writings of Madame Blavatsky. Most Americans, of course, you go to college, you never read about Madame Blavatsky, and she's had a profound impact on our society, and as Joseph was saying, many of the key financial backers of Adolf Hitler were tied into the occult, just as many of the key financial backers of this country were people like J.P. Morgan, like Henry Ford, like Mr. Carnegie, the Mellons, the Rockefellers, all involved in the occult, which helps Vader understand what's going on in America. But we have to understand the prototypes have been pretty well studied in Germany. Go ahead.
Well, I was mentioning during your break that the establishment by Heinrich Himmler of what was called the Ahnenerbedienst, the Ancestral Research Bureau, and in the brief that he decreed the establishment of this department of the SS, he indicated that one of its specific purposes was to investigate all avenues of esoteric and occult tradition for precisely military application, its potential for military use. And we do certainly see in this country, beginning in the 1950s with Project Artichoke and MK Ultra and so on and so forth, we certainly see kind of an esotericizing or occultizing of some aspects of American intelligence gathering, of military doctrine and so on and so forth. You mentioned unit patches and various sorts of talismans that the U.S. military has adopted, and much of this practice actually does stem very directly from Nazi research during the war. And there's another thing I should mention in this respect. I kind of call it the pharmatization of America, or, you know, the idea that we have a pill for just about everything. You can turn on the TV now and you get all these wild commercials for these wonder drugs that do this and that, but then you have a long string of side effects, you know, that this drug could kill you by various means. But, you know, this really kind of begins in Nazi Germany, as far as I'm concerned, with the whole idea that, you know, that Hitler did actually try on his own troops the experimental use of speed and methamphetamines and other types of drugs to enhance their fighting capability. So everything became in Nazi Germany, Dr. Monteith, a push for war. War of this sort or war of that sort. And we have certainly seen that happen to the United States in the post-war period. We've had wars on poverty, wars on drugs, wars on this, wars on that, you know, and they talk peace, but there's no peace. So I find our spiritual condition, as you say, remarkably similar.
Well, of course, one of the fascinating things was, didn't the Nazis try to tap into the supernatural for military technology?
Well, there are a number of indications that they were certainly dabbling with what we would probably consider to be supernatural. For example, in one of my first books about this whole subject, I pointed out that experiments were conducted by the SS and the German Navy at the time using pendulums, basically as sort of divining rods, to figure out the position of submarines. Now, that sounds to us rather ludicrous, but the experiments, apparently, are still classified, and I suspect that they led or formed the basis to some of our own work in so-called remote viewing that began with the SRI, Stanford Research Institute, in the 1970s. So, yes, they were involved in just a whole host of projects, and it's a rather dizzying array when you get right down to it. And the interesting part of that story is much of that evidence was kept out of the public eye, incidentally, at the Nuremberg tribunals, because the extent of this involvement was so pervasive that the victorious Allied powers thought that, you know, we'd best kind of keep this quiet. We don't think people are ready for it. And, of course, I think one of their motivations was they were doing some some very interesting things, and we'd better look into this too. So that was the other motivation.
Well, don't you cover at all in any of your books, you know, the efforts by our military to look into the supernatural, to tap into the other dimension of foreign military technology and the ability to be, have a more effective military?
No, I really don't, but I do know several authors that do that, Jim Mars being one of them, who's
right.
written several books about that subject. But it certainly is clear to me, let's put it that way, that if we look at Nazi Germany in a certain way, we have, for the first time in history, really, since all the way back perhaps to ancient Egypt or Babylonia, a modern, technologically sophisticated nation-state that sought very consciously and deliberately to ground itself not only in opposition to its received Judeo-Christian tradition, but to revive many of what it considered these ancient esoteric and magical practices. And that's really, you know, when you look at it that way, that's quite a whopper, because it's, in a certain sense, it's turning the clock way back. But the pattern is very clear, because you see the post-war allies, after they get their hands at the end of the war on some of these Nazi documents and research experiments, you find them entering into the same process. And I don't think what we realized at the time fully was that when you take aspects of the science that the Nazis develop, you're taking aspects of the ideology as well. And, you know, my word, if you look around the United States today, the creeping fascism is obvious and apparent. So, yeah, I think we're beginning to pay the piper for some very bad decisions made after the war.
And I think it's so important, though, that people do understand that the supernatural forces are not imaginary, they're real.
They're real.
I think that maybe sometimes the Germans exaggerated them and
sure.
this idea of this super race. But you get at all into some of the expeditions that were carried out by the Nazis in search of certain items, certainly religious items that they thought would give them supernatural power.
Well, yes, I do, and that's an excellent point. One of the most famous of these, of course, was the Schaefer expedition to Tibet during 1938 and 39. And unusually, the German expedition actually gained entrance into the Potala at Lhasa Apso, the Tibetan Buddhist monastery sort of capital there. And in the Potala, if you dig around and research long enough, you'll discover that there's this vast library of very, very old Tibetan Buddhist manuscripts, which, according to their own tradition, some of which date back to what we would probably in the West call Atlantis or Atlantean times. Well, the German expedition was successful, so successful, in ingratiating themselves to the regent of Tibet, that he gave them a copy of this ancient Tibetan epic, which is called the Kang Shur, and the German expedition made it back to Nazi Germany with this entire volume, some 140 wooden-bound book volumes, very, very old volumes. The interesting thing, Dr. Monteith, is that at the end of the war, when the Russians entered Berlin, they discovered approximately 1,000 Tibetan Buddhist monks in SS uniforms that had committed ritual suicide rather than be captured by the Russians. But the question is how did they get there? We don't know of any other expedition that the Nazis led during the war to Tibet. Certainly during the war it would have been difficult for these monks to get out of Tibet and all the way to Germany. So something happened probably during the war to get them there. But my suspicion is that they were brought to Germany to translate this work. And at the end of the war, we have absolutely, and I've dug into this question, we have absolutely no clue what happened to that copy of this ancient Tibetan Buddhist manuscript. It has simply completely gone missing.
But of course, didn't they believe, of course, if they could tap into this knowledge, they would have really supernatural power?
Yes.
Didn't they believe that the Aryan race, and they believed, of course, that the northern Europeans came from the Aryans, that they'd actually originated in that part of the world out there in Tibet?
Yes, that certainly was part of it. In fact, that's another excellent point you make, because one of the sponsors, the personal sponsors of this expedition, was Heinrich Himmler himself, and that was precisely his hope in sending this expedition to Tibet, was that they would find some sort of genetic or racial link between the so-called Aryan peoples in Europe and ancient Tibet. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the films that the German expedition took while it was on that expedition, they were taking all sorts of biological, biophysical, and physiological measurements of Tibetan people, so that they could kind of classify whether or not they were indeed Aryan.
And, Chris, this was an essential part of the Nazi movement. Now,
yes.
Why did they suppress it at Nuremberg? And, of course, we have a book written by some occultists who tell us that this information was suppressed at Nuremberg, specifically at the request of Winston Churchill. Why would Churchill suppress it? Because he himself was involved with the occult. He was a druid. He was a mason. And, of course, the last thing they wanted is for the British and the American public to understand this undertone of the supernatural that was behind the Second World War and really all of the wars and revolutions and really what's going on in America today. Well, I guess it's Joseph Farrell. We're talking about the Nazi fascination with the supernatural. And of course, some people believe that, some of the tremendous military advances they made, I mean, they really had developed many things. Some people, even Jim Mars has written that he thinks that they may well have developed the atom bomb, but it was too close to the end of the war. They didn't want to use it for fear that it could be terrible reprisals against them. But they had certainly made some amazing, scientific discoveries, hadn't they?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, I'm glad you mentioned Jim Mars, because when he talks about the atom bomb and the Nazi program being successful, it's largely my research that he's citing.
I see. Well,
that's coming from me.
That's the highest form of flattery, when somebody takes your research. And, of course, Jim does that. He gets information from all sorts of sources.
Oh, yeah.
And I think he probably references you there.
Yes, he does. I wasn't trying to say that he didn't. No. He references my work rather thoroughly, as a matter of fact. I wanted to point out that I've done a lot of research on the Nazi atom bomb, and basically you're correct. They detonated one, as far as I've been able to pin down, about October 10th to 11th of 1944, but if you stop and think about it, that's fully 8 months ahead of the Manhattan Project and our first atom bomb detonation. And I've told quite a story in all of my books about this aspect of the Nazi secret research, because it's my belief that at the end of the war, none other than Martin Bormann himself was personally overseeing the division of the spoils between the East and the West. But it's very clear to me that some of the most very advanced technology that they were researching, they kept in their own Nazi hands and continued researching them after the war, specifically in places like Argentina and Brazil. So, he gave away essentially the components for the uranium atom bomb to the United States at the end of the war. So this gives you an indicator of the potential significance of the technology that they're keeping to themselves.
Well, one of the things I think that's so little known by the average American is the fact that Martin Bormann and Dr. Mengele and so many of the Nazis escaped to South America, but they could not have accomplished that without the full help and support of MI6 and, of course, the Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, I think there is certainly an American and British role, but I don't think that we need really to posit the necessity that they had help, because the network that Bormann set up and how he did things, I think they would have been able to pull off a significant amount of it on their own steam anyway. But I do think, yes, there had to have been at some level, particularly in the case of the CIA, and I kind of hint at this in my last book called The Nazi International, there had to have been, Dr. Monteith, a level of at least American suspicion and knowledge that this whole kind of Nazi International was alive and well and more or less headquartered in Latin America. But it was a quite extensive worldwide network. They had deeply, deeply penetrated the Middle East. They had certainly a very, very heavy on-the-ground intelligence presence inside of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. They certainly manipulated events in Asia.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Joseph Farrell. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joseph is talking about the Nazi network that was established after the war. And, of course, this was established by Martin Bormann and some of the leading Nazis. Knowing that they were going to lose the war, they began to making plans for what they would do after the war. And, of course, to continue their research, to continue their accumulation of wealth. Now, of course, I think those people who've studied it, believe that the Central Intelligence Agency, the MI6, and even certain elements within the Vatican, because there are dark elements within the CIA, within the MI6, within the Vatican, which the average person there in the CIA, the MI6 and Vatican don't know about, but of course they were in perfect agreement with the occult beliefs of the Nazis. But of course they, certainly after the war, why the Germans, established corporations all throughout the world, and some of the great corporations that exist today are simply, the protege of the product, or the progeny, perhaps we should use, the progeny of the Nazi movement. But the American people are never allowed to know. And all we hear, oh my goodness, we've trapped down some Nazi who died 10 years ago. But the vast majority of them were allowed to go to South America, and that was totally suppressed from the American people. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Oh yes, absolutely. And to kind of bring it into a contemporary light, and I know probably your listeners are familiar with some aspects of this story, but to bring it into a contemporary light, let's go back to the founding of the Bilderberg Group by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. What most people don't take into consideration in their view or research of that group, excuse me, is that if we look at Prince Bernhard, he was an SS officer. He was a vice president on the board of IG Farben, which incidentally, if you research IG Farben, it was only finally liquidated, Dr. Monteith, in the year 2003. In other words, that corporation, which was basically Nazi Germany's military-industrial complex, as it were, was so huge and so powerful and had so many interlocking cartel and trust and licensing agreements with companies all over the world, it took that long to sort out. But let's go to the Bilderberg Group for a moment. At the end of the war, Martin Bormann, as Nazi Party chief, is sitting on top of a massive, massive pile of cash. In Argentina alone, he manages to squirrel away some $800 million, 1945 dollars, of liquid cash assets. Now, present at some of those early Bilderberg meetings was also the chairman of Deutsche Bank, a fellow by the name of Dr. Hermann Josef Ups. And, of course, Deutsche Bank is one of the world's largest banks then and today. But Dr. Ups was also, prior to and during a small period right at the beginning of the war, he was a director of a small handling bank in Berlin that was actually the bank that was responsible for paying the salaries of people in the cabinet level of the Reich government. In other words, he was Hitler's paymaster. So my suspicion is that when we have the founding of the group like the Bilderbergs, what we really have here is a quiet and covert agreement between this post-war Nazi International, as I call it, and the British, the Anglo-American financial elite, to turn over vast amounts of this money, which of course will greatly expand the ledger credit entry capability of these Western bankers. But here's the problem. anytime you're dealing with the likes of Martin Bormann, and if we consider the fact that he's got this network of post-war international Nazis, basically, he's got his own intelligence network, and the head of it is Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, who I also believe escaped. Anytime you deal with people like that, any money that you receive from them, it's going to be rather like getting a loan from a mafioso loan shark. Sooner or later, the bill is going to come due, and you're going to have to pay. So my suspicion is, and I have no evidence for this, this is purely an intuition on my part based on all this contextual data, is that the panic that we see now, the economic panic that we see particularly among the Anglo-American financial elite, is genuine, and that somebody is holding a financial gun to their heads.
Interesting conjecture. Well, we're living in exciting times. The whole financial structure of the world is coming down. I happen to believe it's all preordained, pre-planned. They're doing it very, very skillfully. The big banks have lots of money. They can leverage it with a fractional reserve system. They can leverage up to 30, 40, 50 times, their $1 can become $50. There's no shortage of money to lend. They're withholding it specifically because they want to crash the economy, but they can't tell the American people that. So we're going to give them another trillion or two or three or four. And all the time we're telling the American people we're trying to solve the problem. We're doing everything we can to keep it from being solved. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at the Radio Liberty Network. Our guest is Joseph Farrell. We're talking about the Nazis and, of course, their supernatural connections. And they're really connections with people at the highest echelons of the American government. Did you ever come across anything that suggested Heinrich Müller came to the United States? A fellow wrote a book about, Heinrich Müller suggested he was working here. But, I've always wondered if that book was accurate or was contrived.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Dr. Monteith, because I know the precise book that you're talking about. I've read it, and I have great suspicion that this is all a big hoax. However, that being said, I do think that Heinrich Müller was one of the people that made it out of Nazi Germany, courtesy of Martin Bormann and some of his machinations at the end of the war. I get into a very complex scenario of what I think happened in the book The Nazi International, but let me boil it down to this. If we look at three of the most unusual probable survivors of the end of the Third Reich, they are Martin Bormann, Heinrich Müller, and an SS general by the name of Hans Kammler. All of these men have such suspicious circumstances of their death that it's very clear to me that the Nazis had a hand in creating an obfuscated story in order to cover their escapes. But look at what these three men represent. With Martin Bormann, you have more or less the financial genius of the Nazi Party. He knows how to handle money, and he knows how to handle lots of it, and he knows how to use it to leverage power. With Heinrich Müller, we have a close Bormann associate who is the actual head of the Gestapo and whose counterintelligence files inside of Europe were just massive and extensive, and certainly this man knew how to run intelligence operations. And finally, with SS General Hans Kammler, we have the very SS general who is in charge of all, and I do mean all, of the Third Reich's secret weapons projects by the end of the war. So look what we have. We have the three men, finance, Bormann, we have intelligence with Müller, and we have the administration of advanced research projects with Hans Kammler. If all three of these men escape, this is a strong indicator that this post-war Nazi International is not only alive and well, but it is a very organized and very powerful organization out for its own agenda.
Well, I think it's really something that the average American doesn't understand. They think we won the Second World War. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. My guest is Joseph Farrell, who's written a series of very fascinating books, many of them going into the background, of course, what happened in Hitler's Germany, the occult forces were there, what happened at the end of the Second World War when many of the Nazis were allowed to escape and the information was actually suppressed about their escape to South America. Of course, they were brought to America in something called the Operation Paperclip. They went to South America in something called the Rat Line, like a rat with a furry tail or a fuzzy tail. But anyway, for those of you, fortunately, we do have the availability of the Internet. So you can look at these things that are up there. For years, they've suppressed the books, done everything they could to keep them from being reprinted, bought them up and shredded them. Then you try to get a copy of Linda Hunt's book, The Secret Agenda. They're very, very hard to come by. But, of course, the information is there, and we do hope that we even have a four-tape set on Operation Paperclip gets into the rat line. Jim Marr's book covers that. Do any of your books cover that well?
Well, yeah, to a limited extent, much more limited than, say, Jim Marr's. I'm largely focused on the independent aspects of post-war Nazi survival rather than with Nazis working for this or that country after the war.
Well, would you like to tell our listeners how do they get your website, how they can get your books?
Sure. Most of my books are published by Adventures Unlimited Press, and they have a toll-free number during normal business hours. That's 1-800-718-4514. And I do have one book called The Philosopher's Stone that just came out with a different publisher. It goes into some aspects of Nazi and Soviet research. That's published by Farrell House, F-E-R-A-L, kind of the opposite of my own name. I don't, right off the top of my head, know the numbers, so I think probably the best way is to go online and just contact it there. And, of course, there's Amazon as well if they want the books.
All right. Well, now, what is The Philosopher's Stone about?
Well, The Philosopher's Stone picks up on, again, this idea that there is an esoteric or occult influence at work in some of these secret research projects, particularly inside the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. And basically what I explore in that book is the idea that some texts of alchemy betray a peculiarly modern physics point of view when they talk about the confection of the so-called philosopher's stone. And if you look at what the Nazis in particular were doing, or some of the research of the post-war Soviet Union, you'll discover an almost alchemical-like quality to what they're after and what they're doing. So again, it's another part of this, you know, vast story that many of these scientists involved in some of this secret research are precisely being steered or perhaps guided by some of these ancient esoteric traditions.
And I think it's so important that people understand that the basis behind alchemy was this idea of tapping into the supernatural.
Yes, yes.
And, of course, part of this actually was the transformation of the individual. And
yes,
was,
absolutely.
And
yes.
I think that's such an important issue. Everybody thinks, oh, well, they're going to take dross and turn it into gold. Would you sort of develop that idea? Because I think that people need to understand that they say one thing, whereas
they really mean another.
So go ahead.
Well, yeah, you're quite right. There's the esoteric and the exoteric aspects of alchemy. And the whole goal is, of course, the philosopher's stone, to take base metal and transform it into gold. However, you'll discover when you read alchemical texts, particularly during the High Middle Ages, that this is often an allegory for the transformation of the soul of man himself. So you have to read alchemical texts with a bit of care, because they might be talking about one thing or another, or even both at the same time. And we certainly see, if we want to get back to the spiritual aspect of this, we can certainly see in Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union the effort by means of the techniques, as it were, of esotericism to create the new man. You know, the Soviets talked every bit as much about creating new Soviet man as the Nazis were talking about creating the coming Superman. And the bottom line in both cases, as far as I'm concerned, Dr. Monteith, was that they were really trying to numb or even cut out altogether that part of the soul of man that gave some sort of moral compass to human actions and human decisions. they were really trying to create nothing but a race of murderers and killers. So yeah, this whole esoteric tradition, I think, is an aspect of modern science that really is given very short shrift, because time and time again I keep bumping into the fact that in the secret research these countries are doing, this is what they're after.
And of course what they're really doing is trying to find a super soldier who can fight on, who has no moral compunctions, no
right.
moral background at all, will just do what he's done and kill whatever
right,
he's told
exactly.
to kill. Why would anybody want something like that, to destroy the morality of individuals? Well, we're dealing with people who have a different worldview.
Yeah.
Telephone number, if you'd like to talk to Joseph. You've written a number of books. One of them talks about the bell. Maybe we get to that. But if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to talk to Joseph, the telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and he's done a lot of research. And of course, I didn't know that Jim Mars, who we interviewed just recently on his new book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich. That's The Rise of the Fourth Reich. I had actually used a lot of Joseph's material, but I think those of us who are in the research, many times we have to trade things back and forth.
Oh yes, because, absolutely.
And we could all
we
learn
trade
from
a lot,
there,
Jim.
But we have to, of course, be absolutely certain we're right. And
yeah.
really, it's so difficult. Many times people will make a statement, but if they can't back it up, or somebody even will make a statement that really isn't true. And I just got stuck with one of those things recently. Very, very, very embarrassing.
Well, that's an excellent point as well, and I should address that. I do try in my books to footnote and reference things very carefully. I reproduce documents that I get from National Archives and so on in the books so that you can actually see them, and then I actually type out the documents so that you can read what it says. So I try and be as careful as I can with referencing things, but when I do speculate, and I certainly do engage in it, I do try and clue the reader in that this is exactly what I'm doing, that I'm arguing a case here based on such and such information. But you're absolutely right. In this kind of research, it's so very, very important to be very careful.
And of course, so much of this is so incredible that can
yeah.
be proved. You don't have to go to the thought they cannot be. Anyway, but they've got Rich calling us from Hollister. Again, we've got Mike waiting, and then we'll take any of the calls. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Hi, Rich. How are you doing?
Good. I have two questions.
All right, fine.
One, why did the Nazis send the Jews to the concentration camp? And two...
Let's take one at a time.
Okay.
The first question is, why did the Nazis send the Jews to the concentration camps? I think that's a very key and a very important question which nobody ever really asked. Why did the Jews hate the Nazis?
Well, let me give you a Cliff Notes version, but let me insist that the actual answer is very complex. But there are, in my opinion, three reasons for it. Number one, the Nazis viewed the Jewish race as representing the very financial global power elite that they were trying to free Germany from. Number two, with the occult agenda, you probably have in play in the uppermost reaches of the SS and the Nazi Party the belief that certain kinds of magic can only be effected by blood, in other words, by literal human sacrifice. And number three, and this is the reason that is most often overlooked by researchers, the slave labor of the concentration camps was directly under the control of this SS general that I've mentioned before, Hans Kammler, who headed up their secret weapons research. So in other words, the idea that the Germans were unsuccessful in getting an atom bomb because partly they did not have the huge labor supply that we did is absolute nonsense. They not only had a huge labor supply, but as far as the Nazis were concerned, it was an absolutely secure one, because when they were done using them, of course, they could execute them, they could murder them. So that's the three reasons in a nutshell.
Let me just add another one, and that is, of course, the writings of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, who believed, of course, that the Jews were an inferior race. She was violently anti-Semitic. And there was an element here, it really had begun in the United States, of eugenics. And what we want to do is purify the race. And you purify the race by doing away with the people who are mentally defective or who have psychological diseases. And they killed probably close to 400,000 of those. That was before they ever started going after the gypsies. They wanted to kill the gypsies. Why? Because they were an inferior race. They wanted to kill the Jews, partly because they felt they were an inferior race and partly because of this belief in Aryan superiority, which was, of course, Madame Blavatsky's, and, of course, the idea that we want to purify the German race, we want to have a pure Aryan race, and you really have to read Madame Blavatsky to get the foundation of much of this, but I think everything else you said is absolutely correct. There are many reasons. Does that answer your question, Tomich?
Yeah.
I have
a question, though.
I certainly didn't want to exclude what Dr. Monteith said as well. That's certainly another reason. But go ahead. What's your second question?
How many were actually exterminated? Some say 6 million. Some say 1 million.
Oh no, the number 6 million has an interesting history in itself, and I hope to write a book on it someday. But I actually think the number may be higher than that, and the reason being is that the record keeping in Eastern Europe, where most of the Jews that the Nazis slaughtered came from, the Ashkenazim population of Eastern Europe, the record keeping wasn't nearly as thorough. So the Germans, of course, being Germans, kept meticulous records, but they had to do a lot of their own, as it were, research for this grisly activity. So in my thinking, the possibility exists, it has to be held open, that the number may actually be higher.
Richard, we do have a great four tape set. It's called The Holocaust, and it basically interviews with people who are actually there, I've actually interviewed and talked to. And of course, what they're trying to do is get us all confused and arguing back and forth, and they want to divert our attention to a non-issue, not that it isn't important, because it is important, but they want to get us focusing on that. They never mention all the Christians who died there. According to Norman Cohn in his book, War and for Genocide, he was a Jewish scholar. He said 12 million others died in the concentration camps. Why don't we ever talk about that?
Yeah.
And so understand that this all gets into anti-Semitism, and don't let them mislead you. There was a Holocaust. It was a terrible thing, and I've talked to a number of the people, and you can actually hear them in that four-tape set on the Holocaust. Hey, we're going to have to let you go. We've got a full board of people waiting to get on. So let's go to Mike, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. Do you have a question or comment?
Well, two questions, if I can. One is back to the a few minutes ago discussion of the creation of a man without a soul. Do you draw any connection with between that and the Bohemian Grove slogan, the cremation of care, which would be, I think, the elimination of the conscience, or freeing one from conscience?
Well, in my opinion, yes. It's not Bohemian Grove is not a subject I have researched other than very superficially. However, the idea of the cremation of care is to undergo a ritual to quite literally blunt your moral compass, to set it spinning so that you are morally confused. And this, if you study black magic or occult ritual, you'll find very, very similar techniques in use in those circles to do precisely the same thing. So, yes, I think the connection is very direct.
And then to take it further, applying a biblical idea, it would be the searing of the conscience.
Yes, yes.
And let me just mention, we do have a wonderful DVD, which actually part of it was shot in the Bohemian Grove at great risk to the man who shot the pictures. It's called The Bohemian Grove. This is a DVD. We have a four-tape set on it. Information you're not going to get elsewhere. Do you have another quick question?
I wondered if Joseph ran across the word Columbia or Colombian in any of his research along the lines of the Eastern or Central European Society or any of those?
Of course, you're really referring, of course, to the District of Columbia. But any
well,
thoughts on
any,
that?
Any groups that would have been using that name in Europe?
No, not to my knowledge. That doesn't mean there aren't any. It's just I haven't run across them.
Okay, thanks so much, Mike. And let's go to Patrick calling from Dallas. Once again, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 1-866-464-8295. Hi, Patrick. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. It's great to talk to you again. I just wanted to suggest to all your Christian listeners who may be wondering why such occultic influences seem to be so dominant in the governments of the world, that they read Daniel 10, which gives a very good description of how the spiritual forces control the governments of this world and the battles that go on in the spiritual realm. And if y'all have any comments on that, I'd be glad to hear.
Okay, fine. Well, all I can say is we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spirits of wickedness in high places. God bless. Thanks very much, Pastor.
Amen.
So we had to put on our whole armor of God that we may be able to stand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. I think that is one of the things that keeps me going after 46 years. Well, Joseph, certainly your books are unique. What was this one about the bell?
Well, the bell book is called the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. And just in a nutshell, the bell was Nazi Germany's most highly classified secret weapons research project. The Germans gave it a classification of Kriegsentscheidend, which means war decisive. Now, the reason I go into the whole Nazi atom bomb story and to a case that argues that it was a successful atom bomb project is precisely to show the significance of this Bell project. Because if the atom bomb, the mirror atom bomb, is not in their eyes classified at this extreme level, then whatever it is that this Bell represents is something truly, truly horrific in terms of its potential. Basically, I believe it to have been a project that Nazi Germany decided to do three things all at once. It was first a project to investigate the so-called zero-point energy or vacuum energy for the purpose of making Germany independent of any foreign energy supply or source. And secondly, they were after, by dint of the same sort of physics, they were after some sort of a very advanced, if you prefer, anti-gravity field propulsion technology. And finally, of course, they were after a weapon of just awesome and horrendous destructive power.
And certainly it's just a good thing that they didn't get it, and we might all be speaking German.
Yeah.
Well, because the thing is that there were powerful supernatural forces behind what happened there, and certainly when you understand that many of the leaders of the United States, I'm speaking of specifically Franklin Delano Roosevelt, deeply involved in the
yes.
occult, Winston Churchill, deeply involved in the occult, Adolf Hitler and his followers, deeply involved in the occult, you really can't understand anything going on today unless you understand these powerful forces. Once again, you want to get your website out?
Yeah, it's www.GIZA deathstar.com. That's all one word, all lowercase. And the publisher's number is 1-800-718-4514.
All right, well, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program. Well, basically, no, we've got Paul calling from Arizona. Let's go to Paul. Hi, Paul. How are you doing? Have a question for our guest?
No, I wanted to weigh in on this, why the Jews went through the Holocaust.
All right, fine.
I picked it up out of A. Marzulli. I can't recall his first name.
You're talking about Lynn Marzulli, the minister we have on very frequently, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural?
Yeah.
Okay.
I picked it up out of one of his books. Holocaust in German apparently meant a blood sacrifice offering.
Right.
That's right.
And I think that Joseph had made this point very well.
That's what we've been doing with the abortions.
Amen.
Yep, I would agree with that as well.
They all fit into the same thing. We're involved in a spiritual battle, Paul. And until Christians understand that, nothing's going to change. God bless them. Thanks very much for calling. Points well made.
Fine.
Okay, you've got about 1.5 minutes to wrap up or 2 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, if the listeners want to get a hold of the books, probably the best way is directly through the publishers, which are Adventures Unlimited Press for most of them. For the book called The Philosopher's Stone that just came out, the publisher is Farrell House, F-E-R-A-L. They can Google and get a hold of the publisher that way. Or they can just go to Amazon.com because they're all listed up there at Amazon.
Well, of course, this whole idea of the Philosopher's Stone, this is what people have been looking for since the beginning of time.
Yep.
It's going to give us supernatural power. But is it going to give us supernatural power?
Well, I don't know so much about supernatural power. I do know that the physics that they are that it represents and that they're investigating is extraordinarily dangerous.
I know, and of course the thing is that sometimes people are educated beyond their intelligence. We do science, and we delve into things we should never delve into. We'd be far better off if they'd never discovered nuclear energy.
Yeah, I happen to agree with you. I think our intelligence has outstripped our spiritual capacity to handle it.
But you know, one of the things that I'm intrigued by is that many times these ideas really do come from the supernatural. I'm firmly convinced that Thomas Edison's electricity and Tesla's discoveries of electricity really came from their tapping into the supernatural.
Yes, in Tesla's case, I think that there's definitely a hidden story there. Absolutely.
And well, maybe that'll be a subject for another book. Nobody's ever written about it. But I think that, of course, we know that Edison was a disciple of Madame Blavatsky, and well, maybe next time you can tell us about Nikola Tesla. Anyway, God bless. It's been loads of fun. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Bye
bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope you've enjoyed our programs with Joseph Farrell. And I certainly always enjoy the second time we've talked to him, and a very nice person who's doing a lot of great research. And you must understand the supernatural element of what's going on. If you haven't heard our four-tape set or four-CD set on the supernatural, our interviews with Joanna Michelson, or read her book, The Beautiful Side of Evil, you need to get it. You need to get the book, The Hostage to the Devil by Malachi Martin, and the four-tape set goes with that. You need to get our four-tape set or CD set on the satanic crimes in the book that goes with that, and that gets into the Bilderbergers and of course the fact that over in Europe, of course, people know about the satanic nature of the Bilderbergers, but not a word here in America. In fact, you hardly ever see the word Bilderberger ever mentioned in the American press. Because the media here is controlled. Fortunately, you have the internet. You can go up there, but this is one of the most powerful organizations in the world. Probably not as powerful as the Trilateral Commission, which now has 11 people on the Obama regime, and of course they always control the financial institutions, the foreign relations. I think there are 5 people in the State Department who come from the Trilateral Commission. There are only 87 of them who are American citizens, and yet they totally dominate the finances of this country. They totally dominate the foreign policy of this country and the defense establishment. An excellent source of information would be Pat Wood's August Review. That's August Review, but of course you'll want to read my November and December 2008 newsletters. They're up on the internet at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And then, of course, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or watched the DVD, you need to get it. You need to hear our talk on the Forbidden Secret, because there is the Forbidden Secret. It's been out there for 5,000 years. You need to hear our talk on the planned police state, and you need to get the syllabus that goes with both the Forbidden Secret and the planned police state. They're different syllabuses. You need to get the great new DVD, and we've almost through 100 of them now, entitled The Eye of the Phoenix. Goes into the emblems on the back of the dollar bill, goes into Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who took us into the Second World War, and he was deeply involved in Satanism, as was his wife. But then so many of our presidents have been involved in the occult, and yet the average individual has no idea. You need to get a little pamphlet on the occult hierarchy. And we give you the background of so much that's going on in the history of our nation. You need to get the DVD, The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, and the sequel to that, The Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital, and then the sequel to that, The Eye of the Phoenix. All an important part of your understanding of the occult foundation history of this nation, in conflict with the Christian history of this nation. Yes, we were formed as a Christian nation, but the occultists were here, and they put their emblem on the back of the Great Seal of the United States. And then in 1935, under the influence of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Henry Wallace, both deeply involved in the occult, they put it on the back of the dollar bill. And you will never look at the dollar bill again after you've seen the Eye of the Phoenix. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV. War. And you need to, if you'd like to get the four tape set on Operation Paperclip, it's an excellent source of information. We have a book on that subject called The CIA Doctors by Colin Ross, and he writes about Operation Paperclip. And then, of course, we have, we have really so much information out there. Just go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. We've got a great four tape set on the Holocaust. If you have any question that it took place, we've talked to a man who was there, and his job was to pull the bodies out of the gas chambers. So what they've done is try to confuse us, get us arguing on all the wrong issues. And of course, they control our reality. They mold our mind. They create our taste. And we've got to learn to be able to think independently on our own. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.